Greetings, everyone in webinar land. This is Bruce Merrifield here with webinar 8 out of 11 total. Notice over here a little footnote. All parties are welcome to cherry pick the slides to create a customized webinar. In other words, if management teams, trade groups, buying groups would like a deck of all of the slides, then email me at bruce@merrifield.com, and I'd be happy to work something out with you. Also, if anybody wants to search for me on LinkedIn under my full name and connect, that'd be great. I post, you know, 2, 3, 4 curated commentary kind of posts a week there, you know, sort of tracking what's going on in cloud e-commerce, as we all have to go to sort of an omni-channel kind of world. This particular session is on migrating to new selling models for 2023. So we have kind of a bifocal challenge. Through the short-sighted lens, if you have net profit analytics, there are a lot of things you can do that add up to what I call a core customer renewal. And if you go to my new website, merrifieldact2.com, you can see it right there. You'll see a tab actually for the core customer renewal roadmap. It's quite an extensive document, which you can skim through and get your socks blown off. It's quite provocative because it's all new and innovative and so forth. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, have to sort of comfort zone that. But so through the short sight lens, we can do things that improve the profitability, service value for target customers and so forth. But through the long sighted lens, we have to realize we have to unweave and reweave the channel models we have with our going on with our suppliers, our business models internally, and even our e-selling models, because there's a number of factors coming together. So how do we kind of, you know, every time we make a decision, we have to sort of kill 2 or 3 birds with one stone is kind of the idea. So anyway, let's get on with the show. Generally, when I pitch all these innovative ideas, and that's what I'm always talking about, because, you know, I want to be a top 5% high performer perpetual innovator, and most people say, I don't get it, I don't want to, I'm just a sales guy. I like to buy low, I like to sell high, I like to sell more, and I like to just get along and, you know, please the customer, and that's the way it's always been, and that's the way I always want it to be. So when we talk about these things, I hear that basically, oh my gosh, my reps won't like this. You know, for example, the reps get paid commissions on margin dollars, whether the account's a big loser or minnow, they get paid. So we're messing around with their pocketbook. They're not going to like that. You know, basically even management on down doesn't want to believe that some accounts are losers. They sort of say, can't we go into this world where we assume all of our costs are fixed? We're not a variable cost process business. We're a fixed cost business. And therefore, all margin dollars are good. And if I lose one margin dollar that comes out of my bottom line immediately, my people are not dynamic or redeployable. No, they're all winners. You know, when they see a P&L for an actual sales territory and realize the whole territory actually loses money, sometimes substantial amounts of money, and yet the salesman's getting paid a commission for presiding over this. It's not their fault. It's just, you know, but that's the case. Again, this is just, it's new paradigm stuff. I've never seen it before. I'm not getting it. It doesn't fit into my old mental models and belief system. And then, you know, most of my reps have been here a long time. Many of them really have not done anything differently than what they've been doing for the last 5, 6, 7, 10 years. They're really kind of just happily rutted in their habits and doing what they're doing. And isn't that okay? We're not going to change them and sort of move into some sort of e-selling kind of flexibility, capability, customer centricity. And really sort of the bottom line is, look, I don't want to risk losing any of my reps to the competition, you know, because for the last 50 years, we've been stealing each other's sales guys, hoping that they'll bring their, quote, relationships and accounts with them, not knowing whether those accounts are profitable or not. We just want volume, margin dollars, and it's all good. And so this is sort of a fear. It's data-free, and it's monolithic, and it's sort of generalized and awfulized, but that's what's going on. So how are we going to sort of Gordian knot? How are we going to sort of solve this big problem? couple of sort of, you know, warm-up things, a little review of some potential selling models. Here is a customer whale curve. So over here, we start with the most profitable customer, and we go down to less and less profitable to the point where they're losing customers, and the biggest losing customers are these little dots on the tail of the whale. This particular customer whale curve is pretty amazing. It's a big distributor, $300 million in annual sales. You can see that they have some, these are the big accounts, big margin dollar accounts, not, you know, big net profit accounts, because the green guys make a lot of money. The yellow guys are kind of break even after sales comp. And then the red ones, the profit drain accounts, are losers. What's curious here is you can see they have 17,000 active accounts. In the little accounts, regular, we call them regular, but there are some that make money. That's a regular plus. So 1,800 little accounts make money. But there are 13,000 that are small and lose money. So you can see that 81% of their customers generate 4.8% of their gross profit dollars. They account for 26.2% of all invoices. So based on the cost to serve model, this works out to be almost 21% of the expenses. So they're losing $9 million in NBC. And these are house accounts, so there is no compensation to deduct from that. They're just losing $9.8 million on little accounts. Now, they spent a lot of money on creating a really big, cool website, search engine optimization, you know, let's just sell more, you know, got to love that volume. And so when you get a separate P&L for the website division, you see that the previous year they had $2.2 million and they're losing $848,000. And again, there's no Salesforce comp, so that is their operating profit. What they've succeeded doing is getting a lot of new little customers. Well, it could be huge, but there's one guy at that place that just bought one small order. And unfortunately, they do not have Amazon's, you know, infrastructure cost, whatever. Their cost structure is higher. And, you know, the web guy, you know, runs this division and freaked out. I mean, you know, they're doing what they're doing and it's all great. And they're getting the way they measure it, they thought they were doing great. They didn't really sort of see the business as a dynamic, variable cost processing kind of business and really wanted to be honest about the costs. And the first reflex, of course, is to look, let's take aside no overhead. No, I mean, all these people are out here. Can't we just sort of look at incremental costs all the way through and somehow change the model so I look profitable? Well, in the Waypoint universe, all the costs are just pushed out of the line item level. So there's no free lunch. If you take costs away from one group of customers, they just get redistributed, you know, more to other customers that drag them down. So there is no free lunch here. But the reason so in a sense, web selling is a business model, and you got to be very careful. I think my guidelines there would be that you have a dynamic jet.com kind of calculator where you say, here's a strict minimum order and freight's unbundled and it's honest and it's real and you've got a profit margin built into it. But then you have order size incentives and you give them a list of everything they've ever bought. You give them a list of top 20 things people like them have bought type of thing, you know, tools to help them build their order. And as they get a bigger order, they get reduced freight, free freight. And then beyond that, they can even start to get a order size discount off the order based on the fact that margin dollars per line item and margin dollars per invoice are starting to exceed the true cost to serve. And you can start to share that with them. And I footnoted a little term here, OptiQuote. If you Google OptiQuote, there's an industrial supply MRO distributor who's actually taken, you know, created a cost to serve kind of model. And it's interesting case studies to look at. So looking at the bigger picture, you know, I've identified, you know, really sort of four different selling models. So I just went through basically the Minnows, you know, wholesale service cost model, really is web selling, cost to serve, dynamic calculator kind of thing. Let's look at these other guys here. Basically, in some channels, there's, you know, big brokerage of packaging materials, printing papers, huge electrical hardware. And we could go on. But the idea is the manufacturer is shipping kind of straight truckloads of stuff to an end user, and the distributor gets billed and rebills the customer. So they're providing a credit shield, if you will, for the manufacturer. But otherwise, there's not that much involvement of necessarily of the people at the distribution level, except for the rep on the account. So there are situations where, you know, reps will control very large volume accounts, and in theory, they could hop from one distributor to another distributor and just keep brokering their stuff. And as long as a brokerage, you know, territory is net profitable, then I just, you know, don't mess. That's just fine. The second one is just the way we've always done business. And I think that if you look at generational preferences, you know, people over 55, pick some number, old school, old buyer kind of guys who have grown up doing business with regular calling reps, and they have a relationship and they like that. And as long as that relationship is net profitable, then by all means, let the customer have what they want. Now, the number of customers that fit into that category and who are net profitable are surprisingly small and shrinking. So you may have to reconfigure your sales territory so that you may have a few old school reps doing nothing but calling it an old school kind of buyers. Because the millennials that are coming along don't want to see regular calling reps. They want to, you know, 24/7, 365, get totally just-in-time educated the way they want. They want to buy the way they want when they, you know, at night or whenever. And they only want help when they need help, and they want e-selling support, like let me text you, talk to you on the cell phone, let's have a quick virtual meeting. I mean, it could be Friday night at 9 o'clock. You know, that's just the way these people, you know, these kids work. So, you know, our e-selling strategy really is going to have to be flexible with each buying influence. In other words, you ask them how they want to do business with you, and then you've got to change and do that, as opposed to, no, I'm sorry, we sell this way. This is the rep you get. That's the end of the story. That's not customer-centric. That's rep-centric, and it's time and territory call efficiency. You know, I want to travel the least amount of hours and get the most, you know, face-to-face time or most calls per day, as opposed to am I calling the right people? Am I interacting with them the way they want? It's not customer-centric. And then, of course, we have the middle division. And then number of the biggest customers, because we want to go out and sell them everything and basically be open to or proactively pitch an integrated sole supply kind of thing, we have to become not only merchants selling product and, you know, educating people about it, we also have to become logistical people and have 3PL open book flexibility, which is how McDonald's does business with their distributors for 67 years on a, you know, ever continuing, innovating, evergreen, win-win kind of basis. And then there's a possibility that we may have, you know, in the mix of all these things, some, in a sense, obsolete, I've always used the term rocket roadsters. These are people that are so organized around making lots of calls and calling them big guys every week and sort of big guys every 2 weeks and not so big of guys every 3 weeks. I had one sales guy who had A through M accounts, or, you know, what are the 12th letter in the alphabet, A through L accounts, where there were some accounts he only called them once a year. Those were the L accounts. And, you know, he was all about efficiency, and he'd go in to make a call. He'd set his little timer on his watch, and when it beep, beep, he sort of said, oh, I've got to go. And even if the customer was getting ready to give him a whole new thing, well, next time, you know, it was efficiency triumphing over customer-centric effectiveness. So let's move on here. I've put this slide up in some previous things. I think if you go to Bruce Merrifield, go to YouTube, search Bruce Merrifield Plus playlists, you're going to come across 9 playlists. So this is YouTube playlist number 9. And clips 14 to 17. I use this grid to actually explain a lot of different historical case studies of, you know, big men, big buyers who went from win-win to lose-lose and lose-lose to win-win, and McDonald's being sort of the star overall. But basically, the idea is that we want to be able to teach customers how to buy ever better, not that they're all amenable to it, and we have to be diplomatic about how we do it. But if we understand this, then proactively, we can go after the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of our biggest, best, most open-minded, progressive, perpetually innovating, growing customers and partner those people. And then they grow us at the expense of all the people that they're putting out, all their competitors are putting out of business. Now, here are some guidelines for actually saying the reps won't stand for this, sort of a monolithic statement, to actually having a specific tailored plan for each rep. So first of all, we have to stop the data-free, generalized or monolithic beliefs. Like, you know, all of the reps are on, you know, commission plan. Like, what's the commission plan we're going to put in place for all our reps? Actually, one of the reasons Waypoint uses net before compensation is there is no universal plan. I mean, all these distributors have got deals this way, that way. They make, you know, some guys are in salary and a draw, but the hope is someday you're going to be on our general commission plan, et cetera. So even though they try to push for a standard universal commission plan, which is not customer centric, there are variations and, you know, warts and problems and so forth. Another sort of monolithic belief is right now all of these salespeople are profitable, and that, you know, just the more reps we have, feet on the street, calling on more accounts is good. More accounts is good because more accounts is going to give us sales and more margin dollars. And since all of our costs are fixed, which they're not, you know, that's going to somehow flow magically through the bottom line. So these are just, we got to get in touch. We got to say, all right, I guess this is what I'm saying. And I guess it's sort of data free and it is generalized. Another belief is all reps will have the same objections to any change that we try to promote. I've got to assume that you've got a spectrum of people. Some are young and ambitious and open-minded, you know, and some others are probably, you know, closed-minded and don't want to change, et cetera. So I've got to think that any good rep would say, you know, really the company I'm working for is like a horse. I'm a jockey. I get a fraction of the action. And I really would rather have secretariat to ride on than a glue factory nag. I'd rather make 5% or I'd rather make 2% of whatever I get on secretariat than 50% of whatever I get a glue factory nag, because 50% of zero winnings is zero. So I'm interested in improving the horse I'm riding. So I can, on, you know, my W-2 actually goes up. So I think that there are people who get the big picture, they get the longer term thing, and they're really to sort of be part of the solution in co-creating a new, better sort of expanding innovative pie for all, of which they're going to do better too. The assumption that any or all of my reps could defect or switch, you know, to a competitor, and then they would take, of course, all their business. Of course, we don't know whether those accounts are profitable or unprofitable. Again, that's a bit of a stretch. So for these data-free generalized fears, you know, I'm basically going to channel Jeff Bezos, who once said to somebody, one of his employees, look, every question that I ask, the answer begins with a number. I don't want any golden gut, data-free opinions. I want data. And if it's not perfect data, that's okay. Some data, approximate data, ballpark data is better than no data, this is what I'm fantasizing type of thing. So what we want to do is compute the odds, come up with actually a number for each rep's switchable, could they actually leave? And if they did, how much business would they take and how much net profit would that be? How do you move towards that? I've already talked about being bifocal. And then after we've done that, we'll sort through and solve each rep with data and seeing how they fit into our 2023 vision of how we might be flexibly e-selling our customers. So we're gonna rank the reps in multiple ways, and we're going to find actually a huge quality range and a huge adaptability range. And the bottom line is, you know, you can always protect and keep your best reps today and or your best reps, you know, in 2023 as to how they will adapt and fit into it. You know, humans will surprise you. I mean, you basically want to give everybody a chance to be part of the evolving new solution. Some people may move along a little slower, but they can get there if you're patient and repetitive and so forth. And then education is very important. And I already mentioned the best reps want a best horse, and let's invent a better one. So questions for defection risk number. Are all or any of your reps coveted by any consolidating competitors? You know, they're probably in the life cycle of your industry was an optimum decade where there were still a number of independent distributors in a given metro marketplace. They all had parity lines. It was, you know, so there would be people that might want to steal, poach one or more of your salespeople. But as the world, as distribution channels have gotten rolled up, I mean, private equity guys are in every channel rolling them up, and or regional consolidators just through, you know, acquisition fold-ins, or because they're a little bit better run and more innovative, they kind of just, you know, drive other people, you know, into disappearing one way or the other. There actually are fewer horses to potentially switch to. So it's a game of musical chairs. If there are 50 people and there are 49 chairs, your odds of, you know, not getting a chair are pretty low. But if there are only three chairs and there are four reps, your odds of not getting a chair really start to, you know, go up. Then the second thing is, would the rep be able to find a better value horse? Now, if your company frankly stinks as, you know, oh, well, we got good people, we got good service, whatever the hell that is, and, you know, we just, you know, we got smiles and charm and we hustle, yeah, for everybody, all the minnows too. So we don't really hustle that hard, actually, for the best guys, because we're just democratic. We spread across everybody. And you've got some competitor who's just killing it. I mean, their secretariat versus who you are. Then you have to be concerned, because the superstar distributor basically can see the rest of the industry as their farm club. And if there's any really good guy that sort of emerges, they might go approach that guy and steal him. And because they're growing internally and organically through innovation, et cetera, they have more upside, you know, promote from within, grow from within kind of opportunities. So we'll defer that to the next slide. Point three, are they able, if somebody said, yes, I want to steal you, come work for me, and you can have 100% of the current accounts you currently have, because our reps who call on those accounts don't really need them, don't want them, don't have much business with them. So we have no sort of account assignment conflicts. And then, you know, are the customers that your rep calls on, are they 100% loyal to the rep? Or are they, you know, 80% and 20% of the company, 50-50? There's a continuum there. And, you know, I dare say that, you know, this quote relationship, that's a very vague, unmeasured, nebulous kind of number, isn't it? It's not even a number. It's just sort of a belief. So, you know, you could look at each customer, the super profit ones and the unprofit ones, and say, what's the loyalty factor there? And if you lost some net unprofitable accounts, that can actually boost profits. I know one story where a guy had he dominated in a particular kind of contractor segment, huge losing territory. They tried to, you know, work with the guy. He said, screw you. And he left and took all of his business with him. But it was also unprofitable that even though they did not lay anybody off, the energy of everybody just was flowing to the, you know, the best accounts and the target accounts and whatever. And so right away, they actually started making more money and making more things happen for best customers. So they were shocked that actually pruning egregiously losing territory, the egregiously losing accounts, actually helped the whole bush grow. I know it's a faith of, you know, people just like, don't want to believe it, but that it was sort of an outstanding case. Point four, do we assume that the rep, you know, to some degree, are they 0 to 100%? Are they blind to better long-term results that come from core customer renewal and starting to become more flexible in e-selling business model innovation, where they're part of that team and the pie is expanding and they're going to get their fair share of it? And will, you know, will they fit into that particular vision? Little sidebar here on secretariat versus the NAG, poaching best rep realities. I had the advantage of basically running some distribution chains where, you know, we measured, you know, we defined and measured and sold and achieved and sold and leveraged basic service brilliance like nobody else. And so we were the horse to ride, you know, basically, you know, my sales force a year after I took over one company were like incredulous. They're going, gosh, I mean, look, it was just honest. He said, you know, I'm working less. I have no stress. I mean, I walk in, customers just rave about how great we are. My income's up 38%. I guess I really need to thank you for, you know, turning, you know, really a mediocre, you know, sort of performance company into secretariat. And we then started having industry reps calling us saying, can I come work for you? I'm tired of losing out to you. Not that, frankly, we saw very many that we didn't want to hire, you know, because we had a different vision and we had a, you know, a different caliber, attitude, aptitude of athlete we were looking for. We were really more happy to sort of, you know, recruit and train our own people, and make them, instead of stealing other people's, you know, creatures from the industry, we said, you know what, well, let's go get better athletes and teach them the game, in a sense. So if that's the case, you know, you do have to worry about that. But on the other hand, if you're down here and you're really not that great and you sort of, your mediocre rep relationships are your edge, well, nobody has my mediocre rep calling on these accounts, then you need to reinvent basic service excellence for target customers and customer niches. And I've talked about that in past webinars. You need to team sell best net profitable customers, increase the loyalty to the company. And what happens is the reps comp, you know, goes up. And the total loyalty to the company goes up, but the reps, you know, percent of the loyalty is actually declining. So, you know, it's everybody's winning. The rep doesn't have a magic act, but, you know, does a rep want to have a magic act and make a mediocre income? Do you want to say, hey, it's all right, you know, they're, you know, it's a team and I'm making more money. In parallel, do the rep force analysis to sort of figure out how we're going to reskill our best able reps into new selling models. Next point here. So now we're sort of going to try to move towards a net present value rep risk analysis. Now, what is that all about? Well, first of all, we say, all right, if I've got all, you know, 10 reps, pick a number, and I put them in three piles, A, B, C. A is, you know what, these guys are just awesome. My gut tells me they're great. I wish I had more people like them, type of thing. The C pile is, you know, knowing what I know now, I would not hire these people again. We will gladly impose them on customers. And you wonder why rep avoidance, you know, like I don't see reps, or I only see all the reps four times a year, you know, that kind of stuff is a growing, you know, millennials don't want to see them at all. You understand why that's a sort of a growing trend. I mean, if we have folks that we're sort of imposing on our customers and billing them for it, it's built into the price of what we charge them for, you can start to see a tension there. And then there are people that aren't A's and they're not C's, so they're B's. But I'd point out that I think a lot of those B's would be closer to C caliber than A caliber. I mean, the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm looking around, I'm thinking, you know, what's survival, what's good, what's sufficient. I'm not going to benchmark myself to monomaniacs on a mission, A caliber kind of guys, you know, get a life. I mean, you know, as long as I'm better than those C guys, hey, you know, I'm happy with whatever I'm making. There I am. I'm a B or a B minus. Then the second thing is to do this a little finer, where we say, all right, on a relative scale from 0 to 100, and you have to have two or more people sort of kibitzing on this. So, all right, let's rank these reps, you know, on the scale. And you'd say, well, what is 100? What would be, you'd write down all the best attributes of what a terrific rep does. And it could be even composite, you know, sort of say, well, you know, people, reps that we've seen from vendors that call on us, you know, this is the best guy that we ever had, and this is why 1, 2, 3, 4. And this guy was terrible, and this is why 1, 2, 3, 4. So you start to come up with a sort of a pile of attributes of what's a superstar and, you know, what's somebody to avoid. And then you start to try to rank your reps relatively along the scale. And, you know, first of all, this is a rep development chart. I mean, why wouldn't we sort of, from a coaching point of view, try to move all the reps up the spectrum? So, you know, that's a finer sort of sense of who we got. Then we have to say, okay, that's looking through the rearview mirror. But if we look through the windshield, we look to the vision of 2023, and we're trying to sort of, through the fog, trying to sort of figure out what the cloud e-commerce selling model might be, you know, how do they fit into that, and what do we have to do change-wise, reskilling to sort of get there? Oops, sorry. Point four, then we look at the net profit ranking of their customers, and, you know, that's going to reveal a lot of stuff. And then the fifth point, I'm going to come back and look at that in more detail in a specific slide. And then the C pile, you know, do we have anybody that's really, in a sense, obsolete? Because they have not changed in the last 5 years. They're basically a time and territory calling efficiency machine. And actually, where they're successful, when we look at net profit ranking reports, is on small accounts, small, lonely customers. They show up and they say, hi. Anything do for you today? And they're going, well, you know, it's just great to see a human being, and, you know, we want to see you again, so here's an order. So, you know, you've got this. The good news is they really love the rep and they're giving them orders. The bad news, these orders on average are unprofitable orders. And you realize that the accounts that are loyal don't have enough annual margin dollars and enough average margin dollars per transaction to support a face-to-face relationship call. In the next webinar, webinar 9, I actually go into deeper analysis of, you know, the current commissionable model and all the pros and cons of that and so forth to really help you, you know, comfort zone and unpack this challenge, this problem. But back to the ranking report, you know, don't be surprised if you find out that they have few to maybe even no big net profit accounts that are loyal to them. And in fact, when you look at their territory, they say, well, we gave them a geography to sort of, you know, cut down on drive time and make more calls per day. That's what it was, the time and territory was all about. And you realize, yeah, but when they called on all the big potential accounts or territory, they didn't succeed, so they stopped calling on them. So actually in that geography, they're not even calling on a lot of big potential accounts, or they're under-penetrating the few that they actually get some business from. What if we took our absolute best superstar and said, just call on the 10 biggest current and or potential accounts with extra team support help? You'd crack them wide open, because that's what great salespeople do with great support. And I put down here a case study of back in one of my turnarounds. I had a sort of a star salesman in a little town called Canton, Illinois, and I had a Rocket Roadster who lived in Galesburg, Illinois. And in Galesburg, the 15 biggest potential accounts, we got nothing out of it. This guy was busy calling all over the small little towns outside of Galesburg, getting little orders from little customers. So basically, I took away, I didn't think it was not a very takeaway, I just said, to the Galesburg guy, I'm assigning these 15 big accounts to another rep. And I went up there and called on myself to find out who was selling them and da 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 da. I then took my star. And there was no easy way to directly get from Canton to Galesburg. You had to go winding little roads, and so it was 2.5-hour drive. So, you know, basically the star would go up there, you know, one evening and then call all day, spend the night, and call the next day and then drive home. And he would do that every other week. And I went out to introduce him to all the accounts initially, gave him extra support. We cracked them all wide open in, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 months. And really, the Rocket Roadster in Galesburg was undisturbed. I mean, he did what he did. He was a bit embarrassed and so forth because, you know, in theory, it's his territory and he should have been doing something with him. But so be it. Everybody was happy, except for him. He got over it. So, you know, we have to sort of say that might be a possibility. Now, here is a case study of two reps at a given company. We have James Coggan and April Barnhill. These are fictional names. And you can see James has got a ton of invoices. That's sort of suspicious versus a small amount. You can see the revenue, the GP dollars. James is killing it. He's, you know, got, you know, almost twice the GP dollars. He's got a terrific GP percent, you know, considering how the volume he's doing. But when you get to the NBC, April's territory has got 250,000 and we're losing 67 on James. And after we pay James's compensation of 135, we're now losing 203. Whereas April, after we pay her 88, we're still making 161,000 net operating profit. Now you'll notice that over here, the company's kind of got a general plan. They're paying 25% of the GP dollars, you know, because here's the overall average down here at the bottom. So what happens is that Coggins, he's averaging 26.6% gross margin dollars. You see the overall company is averaging 22.5. He's killing it, you know, he's the king as far as margin dollars. So he makes the most, he gets the MVP award and so forth. But you find out that because he's got a territory, you know, of a lot of customers that give them a lot of small dollar picks and returns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, he's got a losing situation. That doesn't mean that he isn't worth $135,000 in the free market. It doesn't mean that he isn't an A-caliber salespeople. Maybe we put him in the wrong territory and gave him the wrong stuff. This is just the beginning of an investigation. If we looked at the list of all the accounts and so forth, we would start to see stuff we didn't think of before. The point is, stop thinking monolithically, get the data, and then use the data to start to make better decisions. Now, what this all adds up to, connecting all these dots, is the potential to, in a sense, downsize a sales force while you're simultaneously upgrading it. And the fewer better reps, you're refocusing them on bigger, better accounts. You're coming up with new sets of skills because we're going to start selling replenishment economics and in addition to feature benefit product kind of stuff. So we're going to sell replenishment economics and taking friction out of the relationships. And then we have to rethink the compensation. If we pay salespeople on margin dollars, they just really won't get excited about cost to serve. And they won't get excited about sort of taking friction out and giving customer higher value. They're just happy to get the margin dollars and not rock the boat. So unless you start to have, you know, incentives, it could even be, you know, to pay them a straight commission on, you know, NBC, you know, you can pay them a salary and you give them incentives based on different accounts. You can pay them the standard commission program and give them a little bit of an override on, you know, improvement in NBC. There's, you know, it gets down to the individual sales rep level as far as how you, tune these things. This is sort of a general kind of, set of guidelines. But if I took my star guy and I said the bottom 50% of your accounts are only giving you 10% of your income, I'm going to write you a check out for a year for this amount of money right now, and I'm going to take most of these accounts away. If some have got upside, keep them, fine. But we're going to give the little ones to the minnow division, and we're going to, hyper-focus you on best accounts. But if I have a Rocket Roadster, think back to my Galesburg, Canton, Illinois story. If I say to the star in Canton, hey, we're going to give you these, 15 accounts. Actually, we shook them down to 12. And we're going to crack them wide open, a lot of extra help and support. I don't necessarily have to pay him the same incentive plan on that. I mean, more money is more money. And if it's folks on NBC, that would be fine, perhaps. What if I decided that, gee, this guy in Galesburg, the rest of his territory is unprofitable. And I'm going to find a new spot for him in maybe on my payroll or some other payroll. And I'm going to take all those accounts and assign them to the minnow division. And I'm going to take the 12 plus a few more that maybe he did call on and were bigger and maybe net profitable. I'm going to just basically give all the best potential and currently profitable accounts to best guys with extra help. And I may, if I go have 10 salespeople and a couple, two are C's, they may be outsourced, redeployed, whatever. So I'm downsizing my sales force, but at the same time, the fewer guys I have on average are better. I'm going to refocus them on bigger, better accounts. And because we're going to hyper-focus as a total team on the very best ones, we're going to start to get some benefits. And actually, there are five new profit streams that come from this little model. We give everything to the minnow division. We come up with a new sort of wholesale model. Maybe we have an OptiQuote, dynamic calculator, jet.com kind of thing on the website, et cetera. So the goal here is to, keep the minnows as best we can, but turn them into net profitable. And some will leave right away. I mean, maybe 15% will say, I'm not going to order half as often, twice as much, and pay freight. I'm going to go paralyze a competitor who gives me full old-fashioned services, with no minimums and free returns, et cetera, and let them lose money. But the ones that remain become profitable. Then you have to ask longer term, will I sort of harvest these over time? Because basically I have a wholesale cost infrastructure. Humans cost money to pick, pack, ship, do trade credit, paperwork, field salespeople. These are all variable costs, process costs, folks. That's my model. And if it doesn't fit taking care of small retail size orders from small customers who are growing nowhere, I basically can expect these guys to die, go away, whatever. And I've got to focus on, big accounts where I can sell integrated sole supply, better replenishment, take the friction out kind of stories. So that's one stream of profits. We're going to turn losing minnows into winners. We're going to, if we weed some of our C reps, redeploy them, outsource them, whatever, our total field sales expense drops. When we switch a best guy to go call the best accounts for those accounts, at least going forward, we may say, look, I'm going to give you fewer accounts, a few accounts that have got new big margin dollars. So it's not going to be a windfall. I'm not automatically paid a commission. Whatever you've been making, I'm going to guarantee that. I'm going to basically switch to a salary, and then I'm going to start putting you on a Delta NBC incentive, you know, with extra team focus on key core accounts, you know, to really partner them and grow them through the roof. And here's how you'll make more money. But going forward, I'm now going to pay you on improvement, but the next year your salary might stay the same. I may give you an adjustment cost of living. So it's a ratchet effect. And now I'm starting to pay more for penetration or improvement in net profits than I'm just paying the same flat rate on everything, whether it's old business, new business, unprofitable business, or profitable business, which are problems with the current commission plan. So the star quickly boosts. So I'm basically lowering total compensation for margin dollars for the whole sales force. The star quickly boosts old and new account spend with team help. So that's another source of profits. And then this is the ratchet effect, so that my salaries grow slower than the gross margin dollars. And now going forward, future account reassignments are very easy, because if a sales guy's on salary and I take away an account, he still keeps his salary. His total base lowers, but I still give him an upside target. So that allows me to have the dynamic flexibility to reassign accounts or let the customer buy the way they want. Think about 3PL open book. They're going, well, wait a minute, I don't want to pay all that money for a sales rep. Okay, fine. You know, the customer gets to do what they want to do. So new selling model summary points. You know, independent rep territories and paying them on some sort of commission on margin dollars now has too many negatives with it, for particularly for chain doing any kind of change and moving forward into a cloud e-commerce kind of world. And notably, the model has, and I put some of these factors down here. I'm going to dive much deeper into these things in webinar number 9, because again, this whole thing about reps and changing compensation and so forth, it's the third rail. People just don't want to do it. It's, you know, it's a Gordian knot. How do we sort of really comfort zone this and make it very sort of non-invasive surgically, as opposed to let's get out a chainsaw and create some problems? So we're going to analyze each rep in multiple ways, and we're going to design a new path forward for the maximum number of reps who are willing, you know, to, you know, open their eyes and say, you know what, the world's changing. I need to change, and I want to get better, and I want the company to get better, and I want to make more money, et cetera. There are some people that may choose not to do that, or just don't even have the aptitude that, you know, but let's assume that everybody, you know, wants to have a shot. And, but over time, if all don't necessarily fit into the new model, then, you know, we're going to have to make some changes. And then whoever in management will fight for the status quo. So what I've just said, there are people sitting around going, they got their arms crossed, they got a little black cloud over their head. They're like, no way, this is not going to stand. We're never going to do this, not on my watch, et cetera. Maybe there's somebody who's older, getting paid a lot of money, and they've got an override on margin dollars. So, you know, who wants to talk about any of this stuff or change, et cetera? So, you know, I'm sorry. You know, the world, the environment's changing very radically. Thank you, Amazon Business, for creating it. Millennials coming in, the whole world's going omnichannel. I mean, I'm sorry, it's happening. So if you don't change as fast and with the environment, the end is near, either at the individual or the collective level. So, you know, I think that maybe, you know, when you sort of think, ooh, these are pretty big changes, you know, should we, you know, go get a brand new CEO and come in and a new broom sweeps clean? Or can leadership have a point of view change? There was one time Andy Grove said he was the CEO of Intel, and he said to one of the founders, if the board brought in new people to run this company on the outside, what do you think they do? And they said, Gordon Moore said in a minute, Moore's Law, he said, they'd get out of memory chips, because in those days the Japanese were just killing everybody on low priced memory chips, and they would embrace the computer on a chip, the PC chip that they were, you know, was starting to take off. And Andy said, well, why don't we pretend like we're firing ourselves today on Friday and come back in Monday pretending like we're new guys, and let's just do it. And Gordon said, yeah, let's just do it. And they did. So that was a total, you know, let's open our eyes, let's accept what's going on. You know, we have to have a point of view change, and let's sort of fire ourselves and then rehire our new selves, and let's, you know, let's get this thing done. So, if you're a little freaked out by this presentation, this webinar, you know, take a deep breath and say, you know what, maybe I'll go back and listen to webinar 9 and look at a lot of these issues at a sort of deeper, more analytical level. And that's it for today. Thank you very much.